I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Do no harm is a doctor's duty first and foremost, but can politicians take that same pledge when reforming the healthcare system? A study out today shows the magnitude of their challenge. Government economists say healthcare costs will average over $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in the U.S. this year, and will almost double to $13,000 a year in the next decade. And as more people retire and sign up for Medicare, taxpayers will be in a few short years and paying for more than half of the nation's health care bill. Overhauling health care has become a main focus. President Obama's speech tonight will discuss this. It'll be focus of another White House forum next week as well. Joining us on the line to make some sense of this, Dr. Robert Blendon, professor of health policy and political analysis at Harvard University. Dr. Blendon, you know, we've been hearing about health care costs for a while, but we've suddenly felt this urgency over the last few days with letters sent to the president, reports that have come out today. Why has this bubbled up?
Well, there are two issues that are pushing this immediately. There's a short-term problem with a very serious recession. Millions are losing insurance, and a larger number are losing part-time jobs, salary increases over time, and are having trouble paying for health insurance. Mm-hmm. So there has been this sort of sweeping emergency where people are really having problems just paying the bills. Secondly, the stimulus bill that was just passed increases this country's deficit, at least until the economy gets better substantially. And it raised the issue about the long-term issue about how we can afford to pay for Medicare, which spends more than the revenue that it takes in. So you've had this short-term problem of helping people through the downturn, the long-term, and then the proposals by many in the Congress to do something about, before we had the recession, we had 40 million people without insurance, and we had a health care system where the costs keep rising higher than people's incomes. So we have an economic emergency, a long-term budgetary emergency, and then a sense that it is getting too expensive for people to afford normal health insurance in good times, and you have 40 million people who in the best of times still didn't have insurance. So there are sort of three issues going on. What do I do in the next 24 months? What do I do about Medicare over the next 10, 15 years? And what do I do about the system before the recession that created these problems?
Well, and the short-term problems are accelerating the long-term ones. Economist John Palmer of Syracuse University says of today's Department of Health and Human Services report, which we mentioned, you know, the cost of health care, he says the report accelerates the day of reckoning. I mean, you know, we knew these problems were down the road, but now they're closer than they were before because the recession also is cutting into tax receipts. I mean, people, you know, if companies are failing, they're not paying taxes. If people are out of work, they're not paying taxes into things like Medicare. So what are politicians up against? Barack Obama has put this suddenly front and center. What can they do in a down economy?
Well, there are a number of things they can do. They turn out to be very politically difficult. So let's take Medicare, which is having financial problems long term. There really are three types of solutions. We could raise people's taxes and the premiums that they pay into the program. So seniors pay a premium. You could raise them. That'll raise revenue. We could raise taxes for people who work. Not very popular in a downturn. Secondly, and a number of these proposals, when you see the word, we have to have pain, we have to deal with the tough issues, what they really mean is that retirees will get less benefits with Medicare, that they'll be asked to pay a larger share of their bill every time they go to a doctor, or hospital, or drug, and that way we'll reduce it. And then the third thing is let us have the government pay doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, and pharmaceutical companies less money. And over the long term, and this is what everybody talks about, but this is an important thing to understand. Over the long term, we can change how the system works for doctors and hospitals and nurses so they're more efficient and they don't do too many tests and share information. And we clearly can do better about our own health habits. But over a five-year period, it's very hard to get those savings. So what people propose is that the third option is pay people less. So what you see is in the middle of an economic downturn, everybody says it's a problem, but one is raising taxes, one is reducing benefits for retirees, the other is paying doctors and hospitals less. And when you listen to those three, politicians who just thought the problem had to be solved get very nervous about solving it in a recession.
Dr. Robert Blendon of Harvard University giving just a little preview of the conversation that starts tonight when President Obama speaks to Congress, and the issue of health care will come up. We'll, of course, continue to follow it. Dr. Blendon, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, this week we've been also trying to glance at things moved off the radar by the economic crisis. For instance, what's going on in Iran? Tomorrow, Iran plans a test run of its Russian-built nuclear power plant without the uranium that would be necessary to ultimately generate electricity there. But still, a move that has the U.S. worried about what it sees as the growing sophistication of nuclear technology in Iran. Spent fuel from a power plant could be used in another plant to make nuclear weapons. So where does this all put U.S.-Iranian relations? You remember candidate Barack Obama said he would consider direct talks with countries like Iran, and early in his presidency, there were conciliatory gestures on both sides. But then in late January, Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, issued a long list of grievances that many Americans had either forgotten about or already expressed regrets about, including the U.S.-backed coup in 1953, the downing of an Iranian civilian airliner in 1988 that killed almost 300 people, and, with some irony, the backing of Saddam Hussein in the Iraq-Iran war. So where are we with Iran, and where does it go from here? Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from Tehran with a reporter's notebook. And, Borzu, let's start with, you say the U.S. is a big football in Iranian politics. There are so many points of view, all the players jockeying to use the U.S. to their advantage. So what do you read into this announcement that Iran will test run this nuclear plant?
First of all, it's way behind schedule. It was supposed to be producing electricity in 2006, and the Russians have been delaying it for various reasons. Most analysts think that they're kind of playing a complicated game where they're extracting the maximum cash from the Iranians while getting valuable concessions from the West by dangling the prospect of finishing or not finishing this nuclear power plant.
Well, yes, this plant is, you know, way behind schedule, but maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I'm wondering if there was a sense that another message was being sent from Iran to the U.S., you know, along the lines of, hey, you guys are, you know, too preoccupied with your economic crisis over there. Don't forget us.
First of all, I think this is a domestic thing. The message is meant for a domestic audience. You have critical presidential elections coming up in which President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is facing a formidable challenge from a very popular former president, Mohammad Khatami, who most listeners probably remember was the reformist, liberal-minded cleric, a smiling cleric, who was twice elected presidency on a campaign of liberalizing Iran's political and social system and opening up to the outside world. And so Ahmadinejad doesn't have a lot to point to in terms of accomplishments. The economy is worse now than it was under the previous president. And so he's looking for accomplishments that he can point to. And so you had this space launch a few weeks ago with Iran's first satellite being launched into orbit. And so you've had this issue here, the Bushehr nuclear power plant, which is more or less a ribbon cutting coming up Wednesday, but being touted as some great technological feat for Iran that will produce 1,000 megawatts of electricity and show that Iran is advancing despite economic troubles.
Well, speaking of those economic troubles, we know the price of oil has fallen dramatically. Iran depends on oil for its huge exports. We know the Iranian government was considering a bailout package of its own as its stock market faltered. How are people reacting to the problems with the economy there in Iran?
It's a really tough situation now. Let me just give you one little example. I come to Iran a lot. I remember I used to get like a kilogram, so 2.2 pounds of ground beef for like $3. And I went to the butcher the other day to get some meat to make some spaghetti bolognese, and it was $11 for a kilogram.
Whoa.
So it's basically nearly quadrupled the price of beef in the past few years. This is creating enormous stress on people. It's creating a lot of problems on people. They're talking about removing subsidies for various staple goods. These are subsidies that have been there for more than 30 years since the time of the Shah. But because of the economic pressures on the government, they're talking seriously seriously about removing many of these subsidies. This is going to create a lot of stress for people. Now, the question is, as it is in many countries, like in the U.S. or in Europe, are those people who are suffering economically, are they going to vote their pocketbooks and vote for Khatami, who most agree was more responsible in terms of managing Iran's finances? Or are they going to vote for Ahmadinejad, who is sort of this populist, rabble-rousing person who represents their values? And that's going to be an interesting thing in the upcoming elections, how those folks are going to vote.
How much does Ahmadinejad represent the values of Iranians?
The way he lives, the way he dresses, the way he acts, when he meets with a dignitary and sits on the floor, he represents and he appeals to a large base of lower middle class and rural Iranians who see in him someone from their village or their neighborhood, someone who's kind of a street level person who they identify with.
Tell us more about that, because we don't see how he lives. And when he dresses, when we see him, for instance, coming to the UN, he wears a sharp-looking suit. So what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, he's got these little windbreaker jackets that he wears. He doesn't wear nice shoes. He you know, mixes with ordinary people. Let me give you one example of his brilliant campaigning from the last presidential election when he beat the powerful Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani. Ahmadinejad was a great campaigner, and he was once asked a question, is like, look, you know, the way you dress, and it might have been a question that he planted himself, but the reporter asked, the way you dress, the way you act, it doesn't seem presidential. You don't seem like a president. How can you be our president if you don't look like our president? And he responded very slyly. He said, well, what about your servant? Could I be your servant? With a big smile. And everyone applauded. I mean, this was brilliant campaigning, and it really captured the imagination of a lot of people. If he campaigns like that in this term, he's going to be a formidable opponent.
Well, Ali Reza Eshraghi, a former newspaper editor in Iran, writes in the New York Times this week that, in fact, Ahmadinejad has been reaching out to the U.S., and we should talk to him because he has the support of and influence over the country's clerical establishment. Remind us, you know, there is a division there. Some say it doesn't matter who's president. The supreme leader is really in charge.
I think what was the unstated corollary in that op-ed was that when someone like Khatami comes to power or rises in the scene, you have people like Ahmadinejad who willfully sabotage him, sometimes in very nefarious ways, and prevent him from reaching out to the West, prevent him from pursuing his economic program. They use any trick in the book to stop him from going forward. But I think it's a good point in that Ahmadinejad, probably more than a Khatami, represents the interests of those in the military establishment and the religious establishment of Iran, who are the real powers.
Borzu Daragahi of the Los Angeles Times opening his reporter's notebook for us. Just ahead, Iran sponsors Hamas and Hezbollah. We want to ask, how do average Iranians feel about that? Also later today, a town in Hungary gets caught up in the global recession. It was once a hub for the cell phone industry, maybe yours, but now thousands of workers are out of a job. And we reprise our conversation with Jerry Lewis. Some are appalled that he just won an Oscar, but I think many more are applauding. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. We've been looking at Iran today with Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's been spending a lot of time in Tehran. He's there now ahead of the June elections. And we've been talking about Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Borzu calls him a canny campaigner. So, Borzu, I want to refer to a speech Ahmadinejad made this January. It seemed in some ways like an olive branch extended to the new president in the West, but it also contained a litany of grievances, including the 1953 U.S.-backed coup that reinstalled the Shah to power in Iran, that horrible 1988 accidental shooting down of an Iranian civilian aircraft in the Persian Gulf by U.S. warships. American officials have already addressed these events. How much are Iranians thinking about them?
I don't think that ordinary Iranians are thinking about those incidents. I don't think that those are, you know, important historical grievances. But I think that Ahmadinejad is playing a bit of a bargaining and raising the stakes for what will be required for some kind of rapprochement. You know, a lot of times Iranian politicians, they speak in very flowery and exaggerated tones on certain occasions. There's a lot of rhetoric that is tossed around that is not necessarily the position of the government. And I would note that at a far more important date on the anniversary of the revolution, Ahmadinejad made a speech a bit after that speech that you mentioned, in which he did not bring any of those things. And in fact, he said to the U.S. that he was ready to have a dialogue, provided it was in a context of fairness and justice. And he did not mention any of those previous grievances. But I think there is one important thing to note, just as much as the hostage crisis that the Iranians instigated against the U.S. and the keeping of those hostages for 444 days, it has a traumatic effect and it has a lingering effect on America's body politic. So too do these incidents, especially the 1953 U.S.-backed coup d'etat, which overthrew the democratically elected government of Mossadegh, the former prime minister, and reinstalled the Shah. These weigh tremendously on the Iranian political psyche. And I guess one way to interpret what he was saying is that just as you have grievances against us, we have grievances against you.
A couple things that are going to be stumbling blocks in any talks between the U.S. and Iran. The Iranian government has been a key supporter to both the militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas, the Islamist group in control of the Gaza Strip, in conflict with more moderate Palestinians. And many say the stumbling block to peace in the Middle East. How does the Iranian public at large feel about Hamas and Hezbollah?
Well, I think there's a lot of division. On the one hand, there was a lot of sympathy for the civilian suffering in Gaza during the recent conflict. But I think that among ordinary Iranians, there's a lot of suspicion. There's a lot of, I would even say, bigotry towards Arabs and Palestinians. And the Iranian government's calls for supporting the Palestinian cause and supporting the cause of Arab defiance of Israel play well in Arab capitals. But among the masses of people here, even people who repeat the slogans, it's not such an earth mover.
After the invasion of Iraq, much was made of the fact that the U.S. really didn't have an understanding of what was happening on the ground in Iraq, didn't have people who spoke the language or understood the nuances of the language. What is the sense of how the U.S. really knows even how to speak to Iran if, in fact, talks start?
One of the things that's really obvious is that there's a big discussion going on in the Obama administration, and everyone is watching that. And it seems like a healthy discussion about how to approach Iran, when to approach Iran, what to offer or not to offer Iran. And I'll just give one example. Right now, it looks like the Obama administration is being very cautious about what it says and does because of the ongoing presidential election campaign here. It doesn't want to affect the outcome here in a way that'll be negative for U.S. interests in the long run.
Which certainly seems to be underscoring everything we've spoken of. But I'm just noting something in the New York Times. A lawyer who was imprisoned by the mullahs in Iran told Roger Cohen of the Times that to create trust, deception is necessary, pointing out that there's sort of a way of speaking in indirect ways that may be clear to Iranians, but may not be as clear to Washington.
In the Middle East, and especially in Iran, negotiations are indirect. People don't get straight down to the point. You know, you sit down with a cleric here or in Iraq or anywhere, and you ask him a question, you know, straightforward question about politics. And for 45, 55 minutes, he's regaling you with stories from the Quran and you know, serving you tea and talking about every single other thing other than what you've asked about. And then in the last 2 minutes, as he's ushering you out the door, he'll answer your question very discreetly without the tape recorder on.
Huh.
And that's just the way things are here. And, you know, it requires years and years of being here to understand how to operate in this environment, how to read signs, how to read body language. And you know, that's tough.
Well, and, you know, as you've urged us to do, I can just see flipping this question and looking at the U.S. from an Iranian point of view. And they would say, well, you know, they have something called politics. And people often say what they think their people want to hear. And you know, in looking at it and flipping it
exactly.
that way. Yeah.
What's going on in Israel, too, is politics. And you've got, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's, you know, talking tough about Iran, and he's promoting this idea that, you know, Iran is Israel's number one concern right now, there's no other big issue, and so on. And you know, I think that Benjamin Netanyahu is a savvy politician. You know, there are certain issues that he would like to avoid discussing in Israel, so he brings up the issue of Iran. So domestic politics plays a complicated role in every single one of the players in this whole theater.
Well, by the way, do Iranians, do they see the possibility of a sort of Nixon in China moment? How are they reacting to the elections in Israel?
You know, the official line is that the difference between Likud and Kadima and labor is how to most efficiently oppress the Palestinian people. But I think privately they are looking at the nuances. And actually, in reality, the Iranians got like much better deals from the right in Israel over the past 30 years than they did from labor. You know, the arms for hostages deal, in which the Israelis brokered the sale of arms to Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war, for example, was during a Likud reign in Israel.
Borza Jargahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, with a reporter's notebook from Tehran. Borza, we thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, as always, Robin.
Okay, quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, research that shows animals making and using tools like that gorilla, feeling his way with a walking stick. Does this mean animals are acting more like humans or humans acting like animals? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If you're cutting back on spending, you're not alone. Overall consumer confidence in the U.S. is in free fall. According to the Conference Board, it's down 12 points from January, with worries about job security and that shrinking retirement account. The big retailers, Target, Macy's, and Home Depot, all reported lower fourth quarter earnings today. Here's how Federal Reserve Board Chair Ben Bernanke opened his report to the Senate Banking Committee today.
As you are aware, the U.S. economy is undergoing a severe contraction. Employment has fallen steeply since last autumn, and the unemployment rate has moved up to 7.6%.
Bernanke also said he hopes the recession will end in the U.S. this year and that 2010 will be a year of recovery. But he offered a word of caution, saying recovery here could be slowed down by economic problems overseas. Well, that's the subject of our next story, which takes us to Eastern Europe. Businesses there that were booming are now going bust. Currencies in the region are crumbling in value, some down by 40% against the euro, increasing calls for a massive rescue program. The International Monetary Fund is already providing support for Latvia, Ukraine, and Belarus, but the help is not in time to save some struggling companies. The BBC's Ian Brimacombe reports from one town in Eastern Europe, which is waking up to the downside of globalization.
Drive 50 minutes northwest from Budapest and you'll find the town of Komarom, Hungary's mobile phone manufacturing hub. Phone manufacturing is so important here that they've even named this strip I'm walking on Nokia Street. The downturn's hitting the mobile phone industry hard, and mobile phone parts suppliers working in Komarom have announced more than 2,000 layoffs in the past month or so. The latest news came when the phone cover maker, Perlos, said it is halting all of its manufacturing here and laying off 500 workers. Inside the Perlos plant, workers, most of them women, sit hunched at their stations. Nearby, robotic arms place mobile phone covers in the white trays that roll down the assembly line. The workers then stack and organize the trays. All of the people here will lose their jobs. But there's someone else on the shop floor today, and his visit comes as quite a surprise. He's not here to work, but to offer a message of hope. Clutching a Bible, he walks the factory, stopping to talk to the groups of workers who gather on their breaks.
My name is George Sekeres. I'm a reverend here in Komarom.
Tell me then what you were saying to those workers.
I told them we understand their problems, and in the Bible there is many messages from Jesus. We can help them, to pray with them and to show them the ways of the Bible.
But during one exchange, it's a worker who ends up doing all the talking. She waves her hands and punctuates the air as she speaks. She is 50-year-old,
Air Zsibet.
I don't have any problem with God, but right now what we really need are jobs. We're not looking for government handouts. We just really want to find a place to work so we can keep feeding our families.
And how optimistic are you at your ability to find another job now?
It's not a matter of optimism. The problem is there are no other jobs in the area.
When the Perlos plant closes, only around 100 service jobs will remain. The man having to manage the cuts is Ilish Sabo, Perlos's local HR manager. He's only been in the job a few months himself. He says the changes are necessary to meet a huge slump in global demand for mobile phones.
We are closing this plant because our demands for production dropped significantly at the last quarter of 2008.
So your client, the phone maker, doesn't need the plastic covers which you produce in the same volume that they did previously?
Yeah, that's right. This demand dropped significantly.
Do you think people have been taken off guard by the speed at which things have turned around? Talk to me a little bit about how quickly the picture has changed.
Well, it was a matter of days, maybe weeks. When I joined here on the 20th of November, I was told that I have to recruit. That the main task for me is recruiting people. But then the next week, we heard that we have to be prepared canceling of that recruitment. And then the following week, we were announcing that we are in trouble.
And then trouble was meaning some initial layoffs. That trouble soon became the whole plant was closing down.
Exactly.
And so what's going to happen to all these workers?
Well, they have to look for jobs. Temporarily, they will be unemployed. Although several of them, they are coming and they are asking to be dismissed because they have found already. So there are opportunities. I'm afraid that there will be less opportunities than people.
This man is taking news of the plant closures very badly. He is Komarom Mayor Zatiko Janos. His big frame slumps in a chair as people rush around him. A decade ago, it was he who brought the multinational mobile phone companies to the town. And with the latest job losses now topping 2,000, he's got a lot on his mind.
In the short term, we'll need to increase the amount of social support we provide to the people who have lost their jobs. This is going to put an extra strain on the town budget. I've already noticed an increase in the number of people looking for help. These people are scared and upset.
Do you think this is the biggest crisis that you've faced as mayor of Komarom?
In my life, and I'm 60.
Mr. Janos says he's trying to stay optimistic. He says demand for mobile phones will rebound and mobile phone making will continue in Komarom. But this place, like so many in Hungary, is at the mercy of the multinationals. During the past decade, the town has been proud of its record in attracting new jobs and foreign investment. Now, as the downturn drives both of those away, it's also chipping away at the town's very identity.
That's the BBC's Ian Brimcone reporting from the town of Komarom in western Hungary. Well, there is some positive news here in the U.S. The New York Times CBS News poll finds that more than three-quarters of those surveyed are optimistic about the next 4 years with President Barack Obama in charge, and similar majorities express confidence in his ability to make the right decisions about the economy. An Obama spokesperson says he will be honest about where we are when he speaks tonight to Congress. And Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke seems to have studied Wall Street by telling Congress the recession could end this year. As we said, he also said the U.S. economy depends a lot on what happens overseas. But in his semi-annual report to the Senate Banking Committee, Bernanke predicts the economy is likely to keep contracting in the first 6 months of 2009. But he said there is reasonable prospect the recession will end this year and warned that a recovery will require getting credit and financial markets to operate normally. The market is up at midday East Coast time after yesterday's sharp drop in stocks that left the Dow Jones Industrial and the Standard & Poor's 500 index near 12-year lows. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, comedian Jerry Lewis finally has an Oscar. Sunday night, he received the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award for over 50 years of work with the Muscular Dystrophy Association. His presenter, Eddie Murphy, who starred in a remake of Lewis's The Nutty Professor, praised Jerry Lewis for influencing him and just about every comic working today. Well, of course, there are people who don't see the brilliance of Jerry Lewis, but you didn't find any of them at a Barnes & Noble author event back in 2005 when hundreds of fans came to worship at his altar.
The expression was never, "Hey, lady," ever. It was just, "Lady!"
For 2 hours, Jerry Lewis answered audience questions and some of mine as the evening's MC. There were questions about his solo act. He wrote, produced, and starred in films that smashed box office records in the 50s. And questions about his 10 years with Dean Martin. Dean Martin was 10 years Jerry's senior and the big brother he never had. Together, they were the highest paid and arguably one of the most successful comedy teams ever, with films, a television show, and sold-out shows at clubs like the Copa, where thousands were turned away.
I'm proud of my partner because he's very talented, and his talent is only exceeded by his alimony. My good partner, Mr. Dean Martin.
Jerry Lewis's memoir is called Dean and Me, A Love Story. It's a story ultimately of breakup and heartbreak, but one that begins with a 19-year-old Jerry raised in the Borscht Belt by vaudevillians.
When we meet you at the beginning of the book, you're 19 years old, married, with a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Skinny. You wanted so badly to be famous that it affected your breathing.
Yeah, when you thought about it enough, and when you had the kind of a father I had, who did it all and did it so magnificently, and to watch him as your teacher, I'm still working desperately to match what he did, and I'm never going to make it.
I mentioned the skinny, 6-inch pompadour, peg leg, tight pants.
Oh, Jesus.
Rubber face. You're doing sort of a lip-syncing act?
It was called a dumb act because I never spoke. I did an impression of Frank. I had the hair. I had enough pomade in there to move the population of Pasadena down a slope. And I did Il Bacio the Kiss, Lily Pons with a fright wig on. I was the intermission act. And if you don't speak on stage, it's referred to as a dumb act.
Well, then there comes one day, cue the choir singing and the clouds part and the sun shaft comes down on a street in New York and you see Dean Martin.
And he walked across the street and he had a camel's hair coat on, wraparound belt, very casual, but he looked like an Adonis. He had come from Florida. He was tan, had his new nose. He was handsome. And the first thing that struck me was, God, I wish he was my friend. I remember thinking that. It was just something wonderful about him. And it happened. We met. Our friendship really built quickly.
You had acts that were back-to-back at a small club, and you started interacting a little bit between the acts, but you weren't really in an act together.
No. I decided one night to give him a spritz. He was doing a lovely love song. Where or when, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was perfect. I put on a busboy's jacket, and I began to rattle the front table. And that was the first time I was awestruck when he stopped singing, and he said, "And I suppose you'd like to be in show business too, huh?" I never heard such a feed line in my life. I did something. I motivated his next move, and he said, "Come up here. If you think it's so easy, stand over there and do it. Sing something." I said, "What the hell are you talking about? I can't sing." He says, "You can make a lot of noise." "Yeah, okay." Whatever the hell happened in that first 5 minutes started something. Because when we were through, he came to my dressing room, which was a nail. He said, "You were magical talking." I said, "Well, I never do that. You know, I do my act. It's dumb." He said, "But something happens. There's more than just miming." And I loved what I heard because nobody had ever been that supportive.
The beginning of a love story. More of our conversation with comedian Jerry Lewis coming up. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Welcome back.
Before we leave the physicality of it,
Wait a minute. Who told you I was finished?
Sorry.
What the hell is the matter with you?
So sorry.
In light of his honorary Oscar Award Sunday night, we've been reprising our conversation with Jerry Lewis, an interview in front of hundreds of his adoring fans in which I happily played second banana. At the Academy Awards, it was pointed out that Jerry Lewis begat many modern-day comics. He also invented technology that advanced filmmaking. Others have discussed at length whether Lewis is genius or embarrassment. But his fans showed up at this 2005 Boston appearance to hear about his relationship with Dean Martin. At their first gig together in a small club in Atlantic City in the mid-40s, the mobster owners told them to make it funny or else. So Jerry mapped out a strategy. He told me he still has the sandwich bag that started it all and served as their notepad that night.
And I took the pastrami sandwich out of the bag and I ripped it in the center. And it had the grease spots on it, but I took a makeup pencil and I marked one. Do the side-by-side bit. Everything I remembered my dad do in burlesque. I wrote a list of 8 or 9 items. I told him what I would do, where he'd have the chance to respond. We did 2 hours and 20 minutes to an audience of 11 people. By the fifth night, we had 1,000 people around the block. For Dean, he knew that we had lightning in a bottle. I knew that I had come across a genius, and I couldn't believe what we had.
You went to New York, and you know, pandemonium, hilarity ensues. But what you're doing in this act is parting your hair down the middle, popping in the buck teeth, running around while he's singing, taking people's food, spritzing people, cutting off people's ties. Were you ever afraid the audience would sue you? What you did to that audience.
I had people sitting ringside that came there to get their ties cut. When we opened at the Copa, Milton Berle would sit at the center table of Lindy's with every comic in New York. And he said simply, most of you guys have seen them. Is someone going to tell me what the hell they do? He said, so far I hear a handsome guy that sings nice, and a monkey. What was happening was this simple. One guy says, did you take a bath this morning? And the kid says, why, is there one missing? You don't make $200 million with that material. Then what is it? They wanted to see two men who loved one another, and were doing something that they were paid a lot of money for and having the goddamnedest good time. Audiences identified with what they knew the world needed now. We lost kids in the war. We weren't sure what the hell was happening in the Pacific. 45, everybody was really walking around, thrilled that it was all over, but what do we do now? And we, as though God said, here's a very good time to bring them out.
After your films, the critics loved you, and they didn't get Dean, sometimes called him the empty suit. Do you think that that was the beginning of the break?
Oh, God, no.
What was?
Oh, no. The break was just a bunch of people on the outside looking at two people in love, and they're going to divide them.
What, whispering to him?
No, just saying to me, you know, you could do it all by yourself, and all of a sudden, that little poison drip gets in there, and someone is saying to him, what do you need him for? And that little drop is in there. And before you know it, you're buying into it. You don't even know how that happened. How could they destroy this love? It's easy, very easy. You drop your guard when you're in love.
The whole country seemed to be watching and holding their breath when you actually did break up.
When we split up, we received about 900,000 letters. What right do you have to spoil what we loved? When Frank Sinatra brought Dean on the telethon in 1976, Dean and I hadn't talked for 20 years. That was, of course, a case of stupidity, but that's what happened. Frank finishes the number. He says, Jerry, I want you to know, a friend of mine loves what you do. He just came over with me. Could I bring him out? Come on out here, pal. And he strolls out. Oy, this handsome Adonis with his cigarette and the tan and the high collar And I say to myself, dear God, give me something to say. And I looked at him and I said, how you been? And now there's a slight pause, and I said, you working? And then his son was killed in an airplane accident. I called my wife. I said, honey, my partner died today. The light of his life was Dino. And when he lost him, I knew it was a matter of time. He let himself go. He drank like everybody thought he did in his career, which he didn't. And he was waiting to die. So I'm on the phone with him now. I said, Dean, please listen to me. I never called him Dean. I called him Paul, which is his real name. I said, Paul, please listen to me. There's a lot of life left here. There's a lot of things we can do. There's a lot of children that love you. And for Christ's sakes, you know what you mean to me. Don't you feel kind of special with all that love and adulation? Jared, look, I love two men in my life, Dino and you. Now, that's the first time I had ever heard him express love. We get through talking, and I get a letter, which he's never done. And he wrote in the letter, this was the time for me to tell you, I never stopped loving you. I'm sorry for whatever we did to one another, and I love you very much, and I'll try to get through this like a man. It took 4 years, but he died. But what he did while he was here was so much more, so that the day Dean died, Christmas of 95, I sat down at the typewriter that night, and I was going to tell the jerks that never recognized what he was, and I told them that they have to remember, not only was he the best recording artist in the last few years of his life, he made a couple of films like Some Came Running and The Young Lions, and you got to look at a man who was nominated for an Oscar. You also have to recognize that if he wasn't there, I would have been a record act. Nothing more. He was the magic. He was the center point. And I'm living with this all these years. I needed to get it out. I needed to almost do penance for the 10 years he took of being disregarded or thought of lightly. How can you look at that crazy maniac and not see that the strings are in Dean's hands? I'm not being overly humble. I know how goddamn good I am, and I know how goddamn funny I can be, but with him, it was just a little better. And without him, I'm still working at it. But I'll be all right.
Jerry Lewis speaking to an audience at Boston University in 2005. His memoir about the years with Dean Martin is called Dean and Me, A Love Story. This past Sunday, Jerry Lewis received an honorary Oscar. Here, he and Dean Martin perform That Certain Party.
Hold up, hold up. What are you doing? Singing in shorthand? You're speeding. That's better.
Can she make me no stepfer? Yes, she can make me no stepfer.
That's certain party.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
That certain party of mine. You know what? I forgot this and that and quite a lot. What a smartie.